case in our calendar is 99-807, Toledo Bar Association versus Richard C. Turner. Mrs. Resnick has recused herself from this case to speak to the city in place of Mrs. Resnick. Mrs. Keela Farber, who is the president of the Court of Appeals of Ohio, city in the 5th Appellate District. Mr. Jackson.
Honorable Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, Mr. Farber. May it please the Court, Reginald Jackson, Anthony Turley, and a law firm of Conrad Stewart Jackson of Toledo, who respond to the service. We'd like to reserve 5 minutes. This matter comes before this Court on the objections filed by respondent to the recommendation of the Board of Commissioners on grievances of discipline that respondent be permanently disbarred from the practice of law. The Board rejected the recommendation the hearing panel that respondent be indefinitely suspended from the practice, which indefinite suspension is to be served concurrently with a prior disciplinary ruling of this court, which was issued in November of 1998. In that disciplinary ruling, the respondent was ordered suspended for a 2-year period. The hearing panel suggested that the time of the present disciplinary proceeding be served concurrently, and also ordered that there be certain conditions placed upon the respondent for readmission into the practice. The respondent asks this court to reject the board's recommendation and to adopt the panel's recommendation. The issue presented in this case is whether Mr. Turner should suffer permanent disbarment for failing to do something he was never asked to do. I would remind the court that this is a very narrow issue. We stand before the court asking that the imposition of sentence be indefinite suspension, not permanent disbarment. Perhaps to a layperson, this is a difference without a distinction, but within our profession, and to one's career of over 25 years of service to the profession, service to clients, and service to his community, this is an important distinction. This case also has great import to the practicing bar and to this court's role in administering and delivering legal services.
Mr. Jackson, as you know, usually we have an indefinite suspension is for certainly serious conduct, but for a person who we think probably has learned a lesson or can change their conduct. Here, your client seems to have continued in the course of conduct even after having been sternly warned. And the sanction, what I understand, unless I'm wrong, is precisely the same type of conduct. What assurance would we have if we grant an indefinite suspension, other than the fact he has to apply and get to be readmitted, but what assurance do we have that he's learned anything from his first sanction?
Your Honor, if I can put in the context of when this conduct occurred, the respondent was charged by the Toledo Bar Association in the first grievance, and between the time of the charge and the time of the hearing on that matter, this conduct occurred. This conduct was not, as a result, not following chronologically after the hearing, after the court's suspension of November. It was during the pendency.
But he knew he had been charged when he engaged in the second course of conduct, didn't he?
He knew he had been charged.
Did he think he was improperly charged in the first complaint? Or?
No, Your Honor, as a matter of fact, he withdrew. There were objections filed after the board's recommendation. Those objections were withdrawn, and the matter was submitted to this court on the recommendations of the board. The respondent testified that he attended a seminar put on by the Toledo Bar Association, in which Alton Wheel Pencer suggested a form of what he would recall a pure retainer. A pure retainer defined as being available for services. The court is aware that throughout the profession there is a continuing dialogue, an alternate billing, an alternate to hours, so much per hour of charge. Altman Will Pensa suggested that there is provision by which one can be hold themselves available, which is a value to the client. appellants. Rightly or wrong, and we concede that Mr. Zerner was not correct in what he did. We did not stand before the court saying there should be no sanction. The question is, should it be indefinite or should it be a disbarment? Mr. Zerner did go to a seminar. Mr. Zerner, under a mistaken belief, continued to build a client. It was not the same type of building as in the prior disciplinary proceedings.
But the seminar, I assume the seminar would not have suggested that a lawyer should accept a retainer from a retainer from a client and then not give him credit for that when he continued to build them, did he? That wouldn't be. No seminar by the Toledo Bar Association would suggest that, would it?
Well, it was not the Toledo Bar Association, it was the Altman Wheel Pencil, yeah. Which is a consultant firm out of Pennsylvania. And I wasn't there. Mr. Zerner did make efforts to try to, from the first charge, make certain that whatever he did was not
arguing the same person of the Bar Association.
I would take it from your honor's question that you're asking questions which were not questions of the record. The record comes before the court on the question of whether or not, according to the board, Mr. Turner showed adequate remorse. And having shown not adequate remorse, he should be permanently disbarred instead of a definite suspension.
Well, I guess that's a bit of it, but it seems to me we don't usually decide whether somebody gets disbarred or gets indefinite suspension based entirely on their remorse. I mean, we look at the underlying conduct, and as I understand the relator's briefs, complaint is that he took all this money from his clients. That's a separate issue, whether he could do that the way he did it as retainer. But then when he performed service for them, he continued to bill them, didn't give them credit for the amount of money that they had already paid him. Isn't that part of the argument? Okay.
Not as I understand the argument so far. The argument is that he billed for this court, in the Gloss case, in the Schultz case, that he earned upon receipt, so-called retainer fee, is not acceptable. What the Mr. Turner was doing was billing a client for availability and for services to be performed. And at least as I read it, there was a credit that was given. There were errors in the bill. That is conceded. It is conceded that there was, for purposes of this proceeding, it's conceded that the billing was excessive. It's conceded that there was a violation of 206, 8, 4, and 8, 6.
Let me just, one of the stipulations, they're not numbered, but respondent frequently charged the appendix as large lump sum amounts for legal work to be done on the hedge matter in the future. The amount of unearned fees was between $18,000 and $22,000. On only one occasion did the Bendixes receive partial credit for one of these large fee payments in the amount of $100. I thought the argument was, at least one argument was, that he took a retainer fee and then worked, and then what you would usually would work against that, but then he would continue to bill them and not give credit for. That's how we got the $29,000 that looked a little high.
Maybe I'm having trouble.
Well, maybe I should have read it three times instead of twice, but I.
In your question, Mr. Zerner would bill, and he had a continuing relationship, and he would bill. And the question is whether or not he was performing the service, or what he was doing at the time. That raises an issue. But I don't know that he was not given credit. Again, I think I'm having trouble communicating.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I just have a different run, two tracks, and I'm sure later will help me understand it.
With regard to the, it seems to me you're conceding excessive billing. And if
that raises an interesting question, because there were two defendants, mm-hmm. and one defendant was billed $7,500, the other defendant was billed $27,500. We are not taking the position that the higher bill was appropriate, but there are certain issues which are raised in this proceeding. We are conceding that is clearly excessive billing for purposes of fixing appropriate.
Yeah, because he had additional work in the second case as opposed to the first one. Additional
As ours is recorded, suggesting...
Maybe that's what I meant, as ours recorded. But my question, Mr. Jackson, was going to be, if there has been an independent determination that this is excessive billing, and if, in fact, there's been a determination that he charged too much in various other ways, has there been any restitution with regard to all this?
Yes, Your Honor. The Christopher Hedge is now an adult. Christopher Hedge is represented by R. Michael Frank of the Buddha Bar, you know, and we've entered into a settlement agreement, and the deposit of the first portion of the settlement agreement has been put in my escrow account. We're awaiting completion of the signing of release, and that matter will be concluded. So that there has been restitution made on the issue of fees.
Okay, now, my other question is, is the gravamen of this complaint excessive fees? The reason I ask, let me tell you, Rich, why I ask. The reason I ask is because it seems to me that we never really did, particularly through the Toledo Bar Association, we had a committee where somebody complained about a lawyer's fees. You could go to the committee and have it determined. Are we now under 2106 to find that every claim of an excessive fee, where the fee is found to be excessive, is a disciplinary violation?
Your Honor, if you take the $7,500 as being reasonable, and you take $27,500 as being clearly excessive, at some point, the fee goes from reasonable to unreasonable to excessive to clearly excessive. There is little guidance in the disciplinary rules as to that position. In June of 1997, the Board of Commissioners adopted certain procedures pursuant to its authority to the Supreme Court, in which it was stated that if there are fee grievances, that those matters are to be handled by either the Ohio State Bar Association mm-hmm. or the local bar association, and those bar associations are instructed to set up mediation and arbitration panels. There's a case out of, Franklin County, that says that lawyers are obligated to submit to the mediation and arbitration panels.
But at the end of mediation and arbitration, if the fee is found excessive, does that automatically convert then to a disciplinary violation under 2106?
2106, if it's clearly excessive, this court has jurisdiction. And at what point is to the lawyers does it become excessive or clearly excessive?
Well, we have, again, I guess I've got the wrong issue, but I thought the other issue here was his record keeping. He took the money, put it in his general account,
yeah.
retainer, and put it in his general account, which I don't think is appropriate, and then couldn't account for the hours he spent. That's what the board found. So it's not just a question of did he charge the client too high a fee. It's that he never could account for the time he spent, match up the fee with the time he spent. So he winds up with $29,000 for what appears to be an awfully high fee and no accounting for the work he did. Am I wrong on that?
No, you are correct. One question becomes, what is the value received?
Sure.
And on a usual hourly billing client, you spend an hour, you bill an hour, you're paid for an hour. But there's a suggestion through the seminar that there is a value provided to the client for the lawyer to be available.
I can call my lawyer anytime I want to and get advice, and that's the idea of that retainer fee, and that's the idea.
That's the idea.
He or she's available on call.
And the issue seems to be, and the discussion seems to be, what's the value received by the client? There's also a sub-issue here, which is what's the understanding of the client? Mr. Durner testified. Mr. Durner did apologize. I suggest to this court that the board was clearly wrong. He did apologize. He suggested that there was a lack of communication between Mr. Turner and his client, which raises an issue as to what's the requisite degree of understanding. Chris?
Could you explain the Michigan issue where the hedge in that matter, they hired the Michigan attorney to charge $2,250, yet they have collected $4,000 for the fee of only
The record is not very clear and it's not very instructive on that point. What occurred was that Mr. Zerner sent a letter to each of the parents for this young man is saying that Mr. Zahner needed to be retained because of the Michigan matter, and Mr. Zahner's fee would be $2,000. The NS, who were not named for confidentiality reasons, sent a check made available to Norm Zahner, Michigan lawyer, for $2,000. The Mrs. Ben Dixon sent a check to Mr. Zahner for $2,000. And it did not get properly accounted for.
The stipulation is that he created letters for him to pay the $2,450 gave him to the client. But Mr. Zahner never got a copy of these letters. Mr. Zahner never knew the $4,000 was paid. That's what your stipulation was. Copy of these letters were given to the parents and to the defendants to support the Zahner fee. According to the amount of $4,000, the stipulated letters were never received by Mr. Zahner. That's a great issue of fraud in my mind, not an issue of bad bookkeeping or sloppy record keeping. Mr. Zahner, you think
We're not suggesting that it was not a violation of 2102A4, which is what the board of panel found.
Do you admit that your client
created false letters to create a false impression? I concede that the client was committed misrepresentation.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms.
Wiley. May it please the court, Chief Justice Warner, Associate Justices, Mr. Jackson, Mr. Turley. I'm Julia Wiley. I'm here today with Christopher Parker, who representing the Relay Force of the Bar Association as NAS. The record reflects that this is the second time since 1997 that Mr. Zahner has been before this court for violations of the disciplinary code. He is charged with more in this case than simply an excessive fee. This case goes far beyond excessive fees, as Relay or Season. First of all, one must understand how he went about obtaining these excessive fees. The record is replete with evidence which shows that there was a pattern to the taking of these funds. The bills themselves, which have been submitted in the record, clearly indicate that this was not and was never intended to be a pure retainer situation. It is our position that it's nothing but an afterthought. The bills themselves, as drafted by Mr. Zahner, clearly indicate that when he was taking a lump sum fee, that he was doing so to accomplish future work. In each case, the bills would be phrased that this was for time for the present into the future, or for time to complete matters in the future, etc. The wording changed on a bill-by-bill basis. The bills themselves are extremely confusing. I would point out that an extensive deposition taken by relator from Mr. Zahner, he could not explain even one of his billing statements. He could not explain what the money was for. He could not explain what the intention was when he accepted those large lump sum prepayment fees. What he would do is he would bill the client with the lump sum. Then, when he did work in the future for the client, he would bill the client again for that money on an hour, or for that work on an hourly basis at the agreed upon rate of $100 per hour.
Without giving credit for the amount they'd already paid.
He did not. On one occasion, I believe there was perhaps a couple $100 credit given to the client. And we're talking here about thousands and thousands of dollars that were taken. As I say, the bills themselves are very confusing. They cannot be explained. And that is a longstanding problem with this respondent. It is a problem that has never been addressed by this respondent, even though it was a focus of the prior grievance investigation, which began long before the representation of the two clients involved in this case. With regard to the pure retainer, again, as you say, There was never any indication on the billing statements themselves that he was billing the client to hold himself available for future work. He never explained that to the client. She gave testimony to that effect, and he never described that to her in any fashion. He did, at the very institution of the representation, he took from her a more, what we consider to be a more traditional type of retainer, where he asked her to pay $500 and indicated that he would charge against that $500 at $100 per hour, which would be the only agreement that they ever had. But he did also indicate that the relationship was supposed to proceed where he would short and spend time on the file, and then he would bill the client. Well, within a few short weeks of beginning the representation, that relationship changed unilaterally by Mr. Zerner, who began to charge these large lump sum prepayments for fees. When asked during the investigation of these matters to reconstruct for the committee with regards to his billing, because the bills themselves were virtually indecipherable, respondent was able to account for or reconstruct approximately 110 hours, which he claimed that he spent for this particular juvenile matter. Now, at best, for giving him the benefit of the doubt, we're talking about approximately $11,000 in fees. Now, those are still more than twice what he charged the other minor. His charges to the other minor, who was a, as I say, a co-conspirator, who was charged in the exact same instances as Mr. Hedge, was really only $5,500 or thereabouts. The extra $2,000 that minor was charged came from the Lawrence Zahner, Michigan fee. So we're still talking about, after reconstruction, that he would be charging Christopher Hedge double what he charged the other minor that he was representing. But notwithstanding all of that, and again, giving him the benefit of the doubt, he charged an additional $18,000 for no work whatsoever. The bond in this case would be appropriate, clearly, just on the misappropriation of funds from the client. Again, he took the large prepaid fees, never gave credit to the client, never did any work to justify the response. He did take part of the fee that he charged his clients from the Michigan attorney, Mr. Zahner, without advising the client. The client testified she never knew that the fee was anything other than $4,000 or $2,000 per minor. And there's also the issue of him taking a prepaid title work fee from the same clients, from Mrs. Benedictson. When represented at a real estate closing, he required the client to prepay a $750 title work fee. That fee was then taken out of proceeds at the closing itself. And the monies were taken, put in his general business account. They were never set aside in any escrow account or held for that client. And after the closing, they were never accounted for again. We have the instances of the Lawrence Zahner letters, which go beyond simple excessive fees. We have certainly misrepresentation, if not deceit. With regard to the representation of Mr. McDonald, we have the taking of a fee, which again appears quite high for the work that was performed. But the issue there becomes what he did when he agreed to return the fee or a portion of the fee to the family. And in that case, with Mr. McDonald, again, this is a much smaller matter, but Mr. McDonald was terminally ill. He had been diagnosed with cancer. His wife had Parkinson's disease. She was in a nursing home. And Mr. McDonald was trying to get his affairs in order because he knew he was going to die. And so he went to Mr. Zerner and he requested assistance in getting a Medicaid application approved, so that when he was gone, his wife would be taken care of. And that was his primary concern. Time is of the essence. He made that very, very clear. After a passage of time, however, respondent had not completed the Medicaid application. He did bill for 13 hours of time that he claimed he put in towards doing this application. But the testimony of a layperson who later later completed that application for this particular agreement, justified it took her 15 minutes to complete that application and get it on file for the McDonald's. After the, I think it was the daughter of Mrs. McDonald, or Mr. McDonald, saw how much they paid in legal fees to Mr. Zerner, she complained to Mr. Zerner. And she said that she felt that too much had been paid and too little had been gotten in return. And Mr. McDonald himself had fired Mr. Zerner because of the lack of attention to matters. Mr. Zerner agreed to repay $1,000 of the fee, but he followed that up in a letter by saying, here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to hold that money for you, and I'm not going to pay it back to you until the Medicaid application has been approved, because we certainly wouldn't want that money to be taken into account for the Medicaid application itself. Again, this is fraud, violation of the federal Medicaid statutes. Not only that, even at that juncture, he shows that he doesn't know how to handle client funds because he still kept that money in his general business account. He never transferred that over to any escrow account, even though he himself at that point agreed that that money again belonged to Mr. McDonald. Again, this is much more than an excessive fee case.
Ms. Wiley, let me, if I may, take you to your objection, your later objection to the board. Do you know, is there something in the record or something I haven't found yet, briefs, why the board did not recommend, the panel did not recommend a violation of 9102AB, the failure to separate funds, and of course IOLTA lost funds here because money wasn't put in an IOLTA account. Do we know why there wasn't a finding on that?
To tell you the truth, Chief Justice, we were very surprised by that, especially because the panel did recognize that he had not handled funds of the clients appropriately and even stated in their opinion that there was a finding, certainly with regard to the $750 title work prepayment, that had not been appropriately handled. So my thought in first reading their opinion is that there would in fact be a finding of a violation of that section. But in fact, they later went on to state that they didn't find.
Well, I guess if the retainer fee was actually retainer fee, that is your contention that those funds should also have been placed into a separate account. They're really not the lawyer's funds, I guess, until the lawyer has done some work. The client could always, I would guess, I don't know, ask for the money, a return of retainer if it hasn't been work applied against it. Is that, am I correct?
That is correct, Chief Justice. In fact, in this particular case, I guess the evidence that the client in this case did not know how to handle client funds became evident from the very first payment, where even Mr. Zerner agreed that that was a prepayment of funds meant to be charged against at $100 per hour, but that he immediately placed that in his general business account, never placed it in his escrow account, and then withdrew the money as earned. So even long before he wants to say there was a pure retainer agreement, he's already taking prepayments of fees and simply placing them in his general business account, which is inappropriate. And that was done throughout the representation of both of these clients. The escrow account was never used once for either one of these clients.
Counsel, how is it possible that this would be a technical violation for someone to be singing for the express purpose not only of making them available, but for making them unavailable? Someone else would be saying matters that would find on hold. In that circumstance, as a lawyer, you wouldn't have to do much other than tell someone else who might. Is that acceptable conduct? I realize that this isn't very close to what we have here.
No, sir, that is not the situation we have here, because the respondent in this case was defending cases being brought by the prosecutor as opposed to any other civil litigant or something of that nature.
You know, lawyers take a retainer fee for which the principal thing they're going to do is be unavailable.
As I understand the current status of this court's case law, there are certain very narrow exceptions to the rule that prepaid retainers or non-refundable retainers are unacceptable. That is my understanding of one of the situations where this court might find an exception to the rule in stating that you are giving up other employment opportunities in order to take on representation of a particular client. And therefore, I believe in that circumstance, depending on facts, it may well be that that is an exception to this rule, but again, that is not the situation that's pertaining to this case.
What's the value of the retainer fee that makes you available to the client,
every time
you call these
attorneys, you don't have coverage? Well, that was my question to the respondent in this case for hours and hours of the position. I found that to be completely inappropriate and incomprehensible, essentially, because he billed, again, $11,000 for doing actual work for this client, claimed he billed another $18,000 to hold himself available, and yet never turned down one day of work or 1 hour of time that he would have to spend with another client. And for that, I see that there is absolutely no value to the so-called pure retainer, as respondent would apply in this case. We believe that the two coach cases, which were decided by this court, the first, I believe, in 1994 and the second in 1998, are particularly appropriate to this case. And in that case, the attorney was first indefinitely suspended in an excessive fee prepaid retainer situation. In the second case, which involved matters which actually in some fashion predated the matters under consideration in the first case, that same attorney was disbarred for that conduct.
You've used your time.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Chief Justice. We would simply ask that this file would be confirmed by the court.
Thank you. Mr. Jackson, you've used your time, but you're going to take 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This panel, being highly respected, being considering all the evidence, including Mr. Turner's demeanor, recommended indefinite suspension. There are matters in this case, matters found in this case, that this court should consider on the issue of billing, whether or not this court should instruct the lawyers of Ohio as to how billing should occur. It seems to be a current issue raised by the court as to whether or not the basis by which lawyers charge.
Mr. Jackson, let me ask you, why should we not find that there was a violation of DR9102A, the requirement to separate funds and put funds into an IOLTA account?
Your Honor, as I read the court's decisions on earned upon receipt, this court has been critical of earned upon receipt. But there are issues which are not addressed. For example, as Justice Piper suggests, if a client does not wish the lawyer to engage in a particular matter, it is permissible, as I understand the DR, disciplinary rules, for that client, for that non-client, to pay the lawyer to not be in the case. The issue becomes one of value. In this case, there was a statement on each bill, which was maybe not earned upon receipt, but the statement was suggested that as soon as the bill was paid, the money was the lawyer's to use. And so the question arises, what's in the mind of the client? If in the mind of the client, that is money which the lawyer can use and spend, need that money go into an escrow account to be awaiting the exchange of an hour for an hour. I do not believe that the case law is instructive to the lawyers of Ohio that when an amount is received, the debt amount has to go into an escrow or an IOLA account until earned. If in the client's mind and in the lawyer's mind, that money is property of the lawyers upon transfer, there is nothing, as I read the court's prior decisions, that suggests the lawyer cannot put it, the lawyer can't spend it.
Sounds like we need some, maybe not this case, sounds like we need some statement on that, because that's quite a burden to put on the client, to let, have a determination from the client. You know, you're giving the money to the lawyer to do some work in the future, and now we want you to indicate somehow that the lawyer can put this money in a general account or in a trust account. That seems to me that the lawyer ought to have an obligation. We ought to say to the lawyer, here's your obligation, one way or the other. Would you agree with that?
Your Honor, in February 1997, this court issued its decree to professionals. And one of the tenets was that lawyers should, not aspirational, but lawyers should, or practical, have written fee agreements. June 1997, that matter was submitted to the Bell Report to the Ohio State Bar Association Council of Delegates. Now, the issue, the proposal was for when matters were expected to exceed $1,000 in fees, there should be a written fee agreement. That matter was resoundingly defeated by the Council of Delegates. If the issue, the General Assembly has mandated that for contingency matters, where there's a contingency contract, that there shall be a written agreement. This court in 2107 has said when there's a division of fees, in any kind of matter, it has to be in writing and has to be agreed to by the client. If there is to be a rule instructing the lawyers of Ohio to have to written fee agreements, it's going to have to come from this court. And I do believe there's an issue raised here. So what's the perception, what's the understanding of the client, what's the understanding of the lawyer? As I talked about, when does a fee go from being unreasonable to excessive to clearly excessive? And unfortunately, maybe this isn't the vehicle or the case on which to raise that, but I believe that there are some issues raised in this case that suggest perhaps greater direction to come from this court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.